Hi everyone, Reverend Jack here. I hope you will grab a cup of coffee, maybe a tea or some water, and let's have a conversation. Today's topic that we're going to talk about is Where Were You? It's a new series that we are launching here at Elder Pride, and I hope you will be a part of it. Each and every one of us have a story to tell, a story where we witnessed emancipation. A story where we found it within ourselves to be emancipated. But most importantly, we have to capture these stories so that the younger brothers and sisters in the LGBTQ community know what it took for them to stand as they stand today. This was our vision. This was our vision for them to be fully authentic and how they choose and how they were born to be in this world. And so today, we ask the question, where were you? At Elder Pride, we pride ourselves in our series called Wisdom in Living to teach social justice and advocacy. And it's important because it's a part of the legacy of our time. You know, I recently heard the comment, you know, saying, okay, boomer, in response to a tweet. And so I did some research to really delve into what does it mean when someone says, okay, boomer. Well, typically it refers to someone as a millennial speaking back to someone in the boomer generation to say, thank you for leaving us a mess. You know, whatever excuse you have, thank you. We'll clean it up. But you left the world in a mess for us to have to deal with. You left our economy in debt. You left our climate in chaos. You know, okay, boomer, we got it from here. Well, it reminded me that sometimes if we don't stand up for ourselves and remind people from whence we came, they will not know the story of our advocacy, our story of social justice, so that they have the ability to stand where they are today and still see what is to be done, but to appreciate how far we've come. You know, our stories of emancipation start at some point in our life when we realize that social justice is our calling. We may not consciously choose it, but some event happens when we just go, oh no, I have to say something. I remember being in the third grade class of Morton Elementary School when we had one of those teachers that wore orthopedic shoes and walked around with a big ruler and ran the classroom almost like a little military encampment. Every day at 3 o'clock before we'd go home, she would do desk inspection. And when she would open the top of our desks, our history book, our math book, our reader had to be placed on the left-hand side of the desk very appropriately. On the right, it had to be the science book, our writing journal, and maybe a little pencil box on top. But order, neatness, and cleanliness were the order of the day. So our teacher had just completed her inspection for this particular day and went back up to her desk and picked up a group of papers and said, this is the homework that I have graded. And I would like for you to take it home so that your parents could see the results, see your grade, if you will. She passed out the papers, and most of them put them in our backpack, you know, or our pocket to take home. But one little girl, two desks to my left, Cynthia, opened the top of her desk and put her homework inside because she knew that she was not going to see her parents that night. The teacher noticed this out of her peripheral vision and immediately announced an immediate desk inspection. She walked over to Cynthia's desk and said, I will start with you. She raised the desk lid and saw this piece of paper askew, where it didn't belong, and went into rage. The teacher reached down and picked the desk up by its feet and dumped all of the contents on the floor and said, "Cynthia, you will stay after school and clean it up." I gasped. And when the teacher heard my gasp, she looked at me and said, "Do you have something to say?" And as if I was possessed, I heard the words coming out of my mouth. "That was the stupidest thing I have ever seen in my life. You set her up." Needless to say, I stayed after school that day with Cynthia as well. I took a note home saying that I would be getting a C in citizenship for that 6 weeks because I didn't honor or respect the teacher. I didn't care. I felt that I had done the right thing. I felt that I had stood up for Cynthia against an injustice that just did not seem tolerable to me. I didn't mind having a different point of view of the authority that was before me. In fact, I was so cavalier about it that I didn't even give the note to my mother saying that I'd be getting a C in citizenship. So a few weeks later, when indeed I brought home my report card and I had a C in citizenship, it was time for a mother-son chat. My mother asked me, "Why do you think that you have a C?" And I said, "Oh, I know exactly why I have a C." And I told her Cynthia's story. My mom glanced up at the clock and saw that it was about 3:15 in the afternoon and knew that my teacher would still be there. So she said, "I will be right back." She took my report card, the note, and went off to my elementary school. When my mother came home about 45 minutes later, she handed my report card, and my C in citizenship had been changed to a B+ with the teacher's initials next to it. I learned in that moment what it was to have somebody's hand at my back. My mother believed in me. She believed in my advocacy, and when I told the truth about an injustice I saw, she said, "I got your back." Later, in a couple of years, I got to see my mother's advocacy in place one more time as she taught me how to respect somebody that had been bullied in the community. The little town in East Central Indiana that I grew up in had a dance studio. And the choreographer and dance teacher was a gentleman by the name of Mark Ross. Mark was a professional dancer who appeared on many television shows at the day, the variety shows like Carol Burnett and Andy Williams and Perry Como and Gary Moore. And often we'd be watching these programs and my mom would point out, "Oh, there's Mrs. Ross's son." Well, every summer when the shows were in hiatus, he would come back to our hometown and teach dancing lessons. So my mom immediately enrolled me. I loved it. I got to perform. I loved the costumes. You know, it really was, you know, my insight as to understanding who I was. And then one day at work, someone really bullied my mother about how dare she put me in a class with a devout homosexual. My mother, again, called for a mother-son meeting. And she said, "Jack, there are some people who think that it was inappropriate for me to put you in Mark's class. I want to ask you what you think." I immediately said, "Oh, please don't take me out. I love it." And she said, "You don't mind that you're just one of a very few group of boys in this class?" I said, "Not at all. And I love the girls that I dance with. This is fun." And she asked, "Is Mark always appropriate? Does he act like an adult? Does he, you know, speak like a teacher?" "Yes, he's very professional." And she said, "Okay, well, what I want you to know, should that ever change, please let me know. But if you want to continue on, I'll deal with the bullies. And you enjoy your dance lessons." So again, she taught me how to be an advocate and to stand up for bullies. I went on stick dancing lesson for 4 or 5 years. And I did learn about sexuality. Not that I expressed it, but I did ask Mark questions about being gay. And he answered any question that I had, but was always very appropriate. He was a good mentor. Later on, I got to see advocacy from a whole different level. I had moved to California, San Francisco in particular, and I had moved here a year before Harvey Milk's election as the first openly gay city supervisor. I remember the campaign. I remember thinking, how cool is this? But I also remember that there was a bill going through the state legislature at that time banning gay teachers. And so I marched for the right of teachers to be who they were. Harvey Milk was elected, and we celebrated. Finally, we had someone like ourselves in leadership. And then it was the assassination of Supervisor Harvey Milk and Mayor George Moscone. We were shocked. We were devastated. And I remember marching that night from the Castro to City Hall, holding a candle, thinking of the little song that I heard in Sunday school as a child. This little light of mine, I'm going to let it shine. And I knew right then that advocacy was a part of my calling. I had to speak out for injustice wherever I experienced it. You know, soon after that, we dealt with another pandemic, the AIDS crisis. You know, so being involved in ACT UP or being involved in other advocacy groups that really cared for our brothers and sisters dealing with this pandemic was just what we did. And I realized at that time that many of my brothers and sisters were being shunned when they were about to make their transition in life. They were in hospice care, but their ministers wouldn't call upon them. And when their parents tried to make arrangements for their funerals, mortuaries wouldn't touch them. But I was more touched by the ministers that refused to either give them their last rites or to be with them for this transition in a pastoral care way. And I thought, wait a minute. I'm studying theology now in school. I'm studying psychology in school. I can do this. I'll become a minister. I'll officiate those burials. I'll officiate those memorials. I will do this for my brothers and sisters. How dare those other ministers not do this? This is what they were called to do. So my advocacy is the catalyst for my becoming a minister. So after I became a minister, I realized that in my secular work, I worked for the Department of Psychology at the VA Medical Center in Palo Alto, California. And I listened to people say in staff meetings with the chief of staff of the hospital say, well, there will never be a veteran that will have HIV or AIDS. I found that to be quite curious. Why do you think that's true? Well, there are no homosexuals in the military. We ban them out in the recruitment process. Soon, I noticed there were a large amount of men coming into our local pharmacy within the building that I worked to get their medication. Most veterans at that time received their medication on a monthly basis. But these particular group of veterans were receiving their medication once a week. And so, my job was to run a program called Vocational Rehabilitation. In fact, I was the director of Vocational Rehabilitation. In other words, it was my job to help veterans find gainful employment. And I ran shelters and workshops that helped them to do that. So I talked with the chief of staff and I asked the question, why are these veterans coming weekly to get their medication? His response ran a chill up my back. Well, they have AIDS, and so we're only going to give them a week worth of medication because it's expensive. And after all, they're just going to die. AZT was the medication of choice at that time. And the VA actually used many veterans to really test the dosage of AZT to see what the reactions would be. These were marginalized veterans, many that were homeless, that they simply didn't mind trying experiments on to see how they would react to this new drug as they evaluated what would be the proper dosage. So I did something very radical in my advocacy. I said to the chief of staff of the hospital, give me these veterans and I will put them back to work. He looked at me and said, Jack, you're ignorant. I just told you that they're dying. And I said, you know, I don't believe that. I just believe that they have lost their will to live. Let me find an antidote. Let me help them understand that they still have something to contribute. So with that, they begrudgingly gave me 30 veterans to work with and did their own little step test. 30 veterans would not be in my program. 30 veterans would be in my program. A year and a half later, my veterans were still alive. They had found their calling even in the midst of their disease. Many became artists. Many tapped into doing what they had wanted to do their entire lives. Suddenly, they had something more to live for. They continued on. Many didn't make it because this was still early in the pandemic. But I tapped into something where I realized that the will to live was essential. And that if someone else had their hand at your back, I could help you cross that bridge to where you wanted to live as well. Advocacy also came into my life through my role with the Jenard AIDS Foundation in Contra Costa County, Northern California. You see, at the time, many of the funding sources for AIDS and the care for AIDS, people with AIDS, was restricted. Maybe restricted to the county that the patient lived in, or restricted into exactly what would be paid for. So my dear friends Marsha Vera and I, you know, went about creating a new foundation called the Jenard AIDS Foundation that had unrestricted funds, so that those funds could be used to cover the cost of whatever else was not covered by Social Security, by personal health insurance, things like bringing parents out to be with their child for their days in hospice, or paying for dental care that was not covered under other opportunities, perhaps paying for rent for a couple of months while someone's benefits were waiting to kick in. We had unrestricted funds, and we raised nearly $1 million. That $1 million that we raised was invested, went to the patients, but also provided our grant to Contra Costa County for nearly 12 years of $25,000 a year to cover such costs. By the time that the funds ran out, the pandemic had become a manageable disease. But again, advocacy was there. It goes without saying the next steps were repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell. You know, because I, for one, was sharing my life with someone who was a career military person. And when 9/11 happened, because of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, I had no idea where he was stationed in the world. It would be nearly a year before I would be able to hear from him. So, of course, I wanted a repeal for that stupid law. And then we fought for marriage equality. We had to stand up and be counted. So much of our life, or the boomers, have been to make the world a better place for the millennials and the generations that come after them. So at Elder Pride, just like I've shared this story, we want to capture your story. If you have a story to tell of your advocacy that demonstrates where you were at a time such as that, we want to hear from it. I hope you will write me at elderprideinfo.com. elderprideinfo@gmail.com. Again, that's elderprideinfo@gmail.com. And let me know that you have a story to tell, and we will make it a part of this program because we want to keep this legacy alive. Thank you. Now, go stand up for somebody. Put your hand at somebody else's back. You got this. Have a blessed day. Thank you, everyone. Hey, everyone. I am so excited to let you know that our tickets for Elder Pride 2020 are now available at Eventbrite.com. Go to Eventbrite.com, search for Elder Pride 2020, and register today to be a part of our conference and gathering in February of 2020. I look forward to seeing you all there, and my goodness, have we put together a full program. We have 6 in-depth workshops on wisdom in aging, conscious aging. We have 24 sage talks, which are like 15-minute TED Talks that will be empowering lectures that will get you from where you are to where you want to be with the intention of aging forward with grace and ease. So go to Eventbrite.com, search out Elder Pride 2020, and register today. And you've got to move quick because seating is limited. And we will see you in Oakland, California, on the campus of Heart and Soul Center of Light, February 13th through the 16th, 2020. Thank you. See you at Elder Pride 2020. Hey, have you checked out our website at elderprideforme.org? I hope you do. Lots and lots of information there for you that will serve your life. You know, Elder Pride is a focused ministry of the Centers for Spiritual Living. And what do I mean by focused ministry? It means a ministry that is there to serve a specific intention for a community or a cause. Our community are our brothers and sisters that are elders in the LGBTQ community. So if you are 60 or over, you can be a part of Elder Pride, and we'd love to have you. Visit the website to find out more about it. And don't forget, we'll see you at Elder Pride 2020 this February. We hope you enjoyed today's program. Elder Pride is a focused ministry of the Centers for Spiritual Living. For more information, visit elderprideforme.org. If you'd like to email us, you can email us at elderprideinfo@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. Have a great day.